There's a leader inside all of us, and on this week's episode, the turtles discover it's not always a good one. I'm Dan.
And I'm Brian.
And welcome to Deuteronomy. We watched episode 15 from season 3. It's called Take Me to Your Leader.
Originally broadcast on October 13th, 1989, written by David Wise, which I think we've seen a couple of times in the repertoire.
I think so.
And as always, directed by Bill Wolf. In this episode, Leo's confidence is shaken. And Dan, I'm going to lean heavily on you because, as we've all well established, Leo is your boy.
Yep, it's true. I am that guy.
I feel like we're going to have a lot of asides in this episode because up front, without spoilers, there's a lot of character development in this one. And it's some solid writing, especially around the blue one. So let's get into it.
Let's do it.
In the Technodrome Underground, we open the episode with Shredder having an episode. Old man can't get a decent cheese Danish, so he's going to blow up Earth's bakeries out of spite. How very Elon Musk of him. Also, bonus detail before I go any deeper, my auto caption generator keeps changing cheese Danish to Jesus, so I don't know, points for a cheap laugh.
I mean, Shredder probably should find something.
I love his line is, you can't get a decent snack down here.
This is such a funny start to the episode because it's a play on their own pace. You know, like we're so used to them being like, all right, there's going to be a little bit of lead in, then we're going to get right into the robbery. And it's like, no, we're on.
It's been happening for an hour. Did the Technodrome move again too? Because he says, like Shredder says, we're 1,000 miles or halfway to the center of the earth and you can't get a decent snack down here. Last time we checked, we were like 10 miles underneath the crust.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. They keep changing the distances.
Also, have you even bothered trying DoorDash, Shredder? Those guys are pretty resilient. The turtles.
Hell, DoorDash probably has drill modules.
I wouldn't be surprised at this point. Just mount them to the front of a bike. Turtles bust in rather easy, and then Shredder calls them the Teenage Mutant Ninja Wimps.
Got him.
Yep. This is if the cheese Danish wasn't a clue, this is the next clue that something's a little bit off.
That Leo cannot decide on a strategy for attack, so Raph and Don roll for initiative. Dan, we have used the term, this episode feels like a fever dream, approximately 12 times in the production of this podcast so far, and I feel like we were premature.
Well, yeah, this one actually is a fever dream.
If you haven't figured it out, Leo is dreaming this whole thing, as you could probably tell in the next 3 seconds, where Donatello attacks Bebop, who is now sitting down to a nice spaghetti dinner and proceeds to lasso Donatello up with his noodles. Then Raphael gets trapped in bubblegum blown by Rocksteady. I take issue with this one though, because like the bubble he blows is clear, not pink. I don't know. That's like cartoon law 101.
Yeah, I mean the stuff here is just funny to see, like how it starts off like your typical fight in one of these episodes, and then Bebop's just sitting at a table with a table like a nice tablecloth on it, the red and white pattern from your local Italian restaurant. Rocksteady's just leaning against the wall, super cash.
Pulling the real Fonz.
And then that pizza dish thing that Mikey falls through is actually really similar to the set piece in the Technodrome, which they brought back for the toy.
Oh, yeah, the trapdoor. Yeah, there's a giant pizza in the middle of the floor of the Technodrome out of nowhere, like the size of a Buick. Michelangelo gets distracted, and then it just fucking dies. Like... As he falls to his death, hold the anchovies. So Leonardo's the only one left at this point, takes a swing at Rocksteady and Bebop, who immediately turn in the Weeble Wobbles and then knock him back. And all I can hear in my head is that soundbite from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2 in the opening mall fight scene.
Yeah.
That is one of those quotes that means nothing, but lives rent-free in my head for some reason because of the delivery.
Oh, 100%.
I don't know why.
There are so many people I know who aren't even that huge Turtles fans, but if you say that, they know exactly what you're talking about.
I don't know what it is about it. I think it's just the pitch and the delivery, but it's like, it's kind of musical and it sticks with you. Up next, Shredder unleashes two vicious poodles from a compartment who chase Leonardo into a giant cauldron of boiling turtle soup. We are 1 minute
Let
into this
loose
episode.
The vicious dogs.
We're only 1 minute in. 1 minute in.
I want a recording of that line of Shredder saying, "Let loose the vicious dogs." And they're poodles. That's a great punchline.
They're exceptionally small poodles too. They're like miniature, like toy poodles. So as we mentioned, this is in fact a fever dream. Leo's having a crisis of faith over his leadership abilities and snaps awake. Honestly, up until this point in the show, he should be questioning his leadership abilities. We've called it the question many times. He can't make decisions, can't spar against Donatello, clocks himself in the head, so he decides to separate himself from the group. And that makes me think of his spirit quest he went on to Costa Rica in the 2K7 movie.
Yep. I think this is a recurring thing for Leo throughout many of the iterations. I think something similar like this happens in 2012. This definitely happens in the IDW comics after the Dark Leo arc, where he doesn't go off on like a whole sort of quest away from the brothers, but you see him start to take more time alone and just like isn't capable of being around the others for very long. He needs more of this like brooding alone time that you would typically see in Raphael.
Yeah. Now I know they're not executing it this way in this particular instance of the series, but I seem to remember there might be something about like, well, Simpsons did it first when Homer has to go on his spirit quest. But all I can think of is, does a chunin in a traditional ninja family typically have to go on a similar solo quest like that, like a find yourself quest?
I don't know. I'd have to look that up.
I got to look it up, too. But there's something ringing a bell in my head about this that like that might be a thing. But
I mean, like, it's a pretty I don't know if it's specific to tune in or that kind of training, but it's like, I mean, that's definitely like an anime trope in a lot of ways. It's a hero trope of like needing to go on some sort of quest to find oneself.
Yeah, definitely a hero trope. I wonder if it is part of Japanese culture, but I'll look it up.
Yeah. It's funny how like Leo is the one to do that in a lot of ways. And in this series, specifically, like, the three kind of go on it together, whereas Leo is all on his own.
Yeah. Yes. And we get a lot of growth through this. As Leo has kind of come to this conclusion in the lair with everyone home at the time, he just suits up. He puts on his puffy jacket and his beanie. He's like, "I'm out, boys." And his brothers are like, "No, no, wait, don't." And then Splinter is just kind of like, "Bye, bitch."
Right. Splinter in this one is off. A little weird to me.
Yeah. Kind of feels like he was replaced with a Skrull or something.
Like, there's so many times that the other Turtles are like, "Hey, like, we got to do something about Leo." And he's like, "Yeah, whatever. It'll be fine.
We don't want our brother to leave. We like our brother. Splinter, he'll figure it out." He also has very unsagey wisdom in this one. "He who would be a boulder in the path of life must first be a pebble." Raph says, "I don't get it." Splinter says,
"Perhaps it loses something in translation."
"Explain it! That's your whole job!"
"That's your one role here!" Meanwhile, Shredder and Krang are breaking into Mile High Towers. And by breaking in, I mean walking in the front door and then putting a crappy sentry robot out front to stop any cops from following them. The cops, by the way, played by Paulson and Gordon.
Isn't this such a, like, this is the thing that Krang comes to Earth for again, you know? Like, all this other time, he's just stays in the Technodrome. I know they're on Earth, you know, I misspoke there. But, like, he normally has been staying in the Technodrome and doesn't really come to the surface. And he's like, "All right, sure, I'll go to the top of these apartments," or whatever. He doesn't even know why he's there.
It is interesting that he does, like, he puts boots on the ground for this mission. And I guess I can only assume that he's, you know, he's the one running the laser, but not even really, because Shredder half the time is, like, the one relaying the data from it and stuff. I don't know. It's I guess they just wanted all four of them on the surface to give Pat Fraley something to do. Let's take a step back, though. What the fuck is this robot? Because it looks like scraps of Big Mac, but it's got claws, boleros, and a giant rubber band to tie up the cops with.
It's such a weird thing. Like, even all the different mechanisms. Yeah, like, okay, I get some of the stuff, I guess. But, like, I don't know. I think the whole thing is kind of weird because it part of this almost feels like it's still dreamlike because they Shredder and Krang go to this place in broad daylight.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were like robbing a bank or something at first, and they were just like, yeah, okay, we'll do this in the middle of the day. No one will see anything weird with a ninja cheese grater and a brain inside the belly of a baby. And then, like, the cops come immediately. I'm like, okay, good. Like, that makes sense. These two weirdos in the middle of the street. But the call was for the robot. It wasn't even for Krang and Shredder.
And the robot is a wrecking machine.
Yeah. Yeah, he's, like, probably the best thing that Krang has invented recently. Because he actually does the job.
Easily. And there's only one of him. Why are you wasting your time on the purple heads?
Yeah, this should be your foot soldiers from now on.
More bonus trivia. The audio captions at this point have been changing Shredder to Trevor. So I will be referring to him as Trevor for the remainder of the episode.
Everyone loves magical Trevor.
Krang, Trevor use the tower to fire a laser into the sun and drain it and plunge Earth into, and I quote, a deep freeze that will make the Ice Age look like a Turkish bath. Krang says, you really have a way with words, Trevor.
This is a bad idea.
I like the follow-up, though.
Well, actually, I always wanted to be a writer. Being a ruthless conqueror was my second choice.
It's so good to have a backup. I was going to go to school for music business. Instead, I got into radio. Good choices all around.
This is a great line. I love that, like, this was his second choice.
So what would his third and fourth, what were his other backups?
Well, he clearly doesn't have one because he keeps failing as Ruthless Conqueror and you don't see him going back to writing anytime soon.
I have a feeling he's got a whole, like, soft artist underneath that surface. You know, he's probably a dancer. I'm sure he's got some poetry up in that bucket head somewhere.
I mean, I think it would be really great if later on in the series when he gets retired as the baddie and we go to, was it Lord Dreg in, like, the later seasons?
Yeah.
If there's a shot of him, like, actually writing.
That'd be amazing if, like, we kind of cut back and, like, Shredder's in his golden years of retirement and he's just, like, sipping tea out on, like, a lake house.
There's just, like, a passing shot of him, like, oh, there's something happening in the city, and it just goes past, like, an editor and he's got his manuscript. He's pitching to different publishers.
When we finally get done with the series, I want to do a special example episode at the end where we just do a where are they now kind of recap. Michelangelo's a senator. All right. So the Turtles are street side in broad daylight, as per usual. They're looking for their brother. There's a chill setting in and the sun is shrinking. Fuck.
Okay. Another thing about this, I mean, I already mentioned how Shredder's plan is very bad. It will kill everyone.
Including him.
But another thing I thought was funny, like this scene with the turtles on the street level saying like, oh man, it's cold. They say it's like July or something, right?
It's perpetually July this season for some reason.
So Leo just goes out in a puffer jacket and a beanie and it's like 90 degrees outside.
Yeah, nothing really lines up. Like, the snow hadn't started by the time Leo left. And I get he's probably going to want to put on his disguise, which, great job. Face exposed, feet exposed, hands exposed. just incredible work. It doesn't faze anybody, though. We'll touch on this later on the episode, because he has regular encounters with normal humans that do not give a shit.
Yeah, but also later on when things start getting cold, he's like, oh man, if I knew it was going to be cold, I'd wear something warmer. Dude, you're wearing a winter coat.
You're wearing your winter. That's your winter outfit. That is your Barbie Dreamhouse winter outfit that you buy. Like, I don't know what else to tell you.
Like, what is up with this episode? Donnie says it's scientifically impossible for the sun to shrink. Oh, yeah.
Let me just say, hey, we could use a little bit of that Shredder laser this year, huh? So now it's snowing in July. Shredder must be behind this.
Well, isn't he always?
The turtles say, hey, Dad, the sun is shrinking and the world is ending. And Boomer Splinter says, live and learn.
Yeah. Again, it's just like, all right, cool.
Completely
Thanks
dismissive.
For letting me know.
Totally dismissive of this entire scenario. My son is missing and the world is going to end. Okay.
Like, the funny thing about this is I can't believe I'm gonna say this. If this episode was like brand new today, it would almost be more understandable.
How do you mean?
Like, Shredder is a scientist trying to solve global warming.
Oh, Shredder's a hero in this story, is what you're saying.
Splinter's just a boomer who's ignoring everything that's happening around him, doesn't care about his family, doesn't care about the planet coming to an end, and his children are just like, please do something, and he's just like, no.
Make America mutant again. All right, so here's something I kind of want to get real with for a sec. So we talked about how there's a whole bunch of character development in this. Let's talk about the archetypes one more time. So let's reestablish. Raphael is rude, crude, sometimes angry. Yeah. Don is smart, and he is the pacifist in the group. That is in writing. That is canon. Don is the pacifist.
Doesn't Mike, like fighting.
Yeah. Mike is the party animal, something of a savant, and typically the peacekeeper. And then Leonardo is the leader. Dan, I kind of want to turn it over to you because we kind of precursored this a little bit before we started recording about the personality traits that are more important to Leonardo, what actually makes him an individual besides just having the role of a leader, because that's not a trait.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, I don't want to say discourse, but like the conversation surrounding Leo is that like he's the one that doesn't have a personality, and that's why a lot of people don't like him, because it's like, oh, he's the leader, and that feels like such a default thing. It's a job. This is actually something that we talk about in voiceover, where like if you're trying to create a character and you're trying to describe that character, don't use a job as a descriptor for the character, because anybody can work a job. That doesn't tell you anything about that person or how they feel or how they'll act to things, how they'll react to things. And so just calling Leo the leader doesn't really help anybody. And it's one of the reasons why the character gets kind of like glanced over. But I think in all the iterations, Leo, whoever is writing them at the time, have done a really good job of showing how, like, Leo in a lot of ways, and I know we're going to talk about this, I'm sure. Leo in a lot of ways is an emotional core to the team. He is the, like what makes him a good leader? It's because he's, like, the moral center. He's the, like, and he's not perfect. That's like the whole fight between him and Raph half the time, right? Is that Raph is like, oh, you're perfect. You're Splinter's, your dad's favorite, blah, blah, blah. And Leo's like, shut up. Like, it's not, that's not what it is. You're just being an asshole.
Leo gets bundled in with like Cyclops and Superman a lot and just being like that Boy Scout. But the things that make Leonardo more interesting as a character, as a turtle, are his flaws, right? So we know that he's loyal. He's usually pretty dependent. And usually pretty on the straight and narrow and hard to compromise. Yeah. Those moments where he is compromised, of course, being some of the most interesting character development that character has ever gone through. I'm going to go ahead and cite Dark Leo. But he's also something of a self-obsessed geek. He's got a little bit of an ego sometimes.
Yeah, like he's a perfectionist in some iterations.
In Rise and 2K7, he's also a little cringy sometimes. And most importantly, every other brother has had a chance to lead in various iterations, and it consistently proves that Leonardo, his personality traits, his moral center, make for the most endearing leadership qualities. Because the brothers, in their roles, while they don't fail, prove his strengths.
I think, like, the central arc for Leo, when you compare him to his brothers, is like, I mean, we could take a look at the archetypes like we have, but I like coming back to the, like, the emotion of them and how they all feel, right? Like, we know Raph can be very aggressive, that he lets his anger get the better of him, that he can fly off the handle sometimes, that he's extremely passionate, which is why he rises to anger so quickly over his other brothers. He cares a lot. It's not like Raph is like, I don't care about anything. Like, you know, he very much does care, and it's the fact that he does care that makes him fly off the handle all the time. Mikey, I think a lot of people look at Mikey as being the actual emotional core to the team, and a lot of ways he is, right? Even in the original Mirage, like, he was the one who was like, I'm tired, you know? Like, the only thing that he said was like that he was kind of done with this.
I'm tired and I want to go home. That's the only line Michelangelo has in the first issue.
And he is like very much an emotional core of the team, but he's also typically shown as being less mature than the rest of the team, at least early on. And I think that's where he juxtaposes to Leo, where like Leo has that same kind of emotional connection with everybody, with his brothers, but he has been forced to be the mature one, which can be very hard for a kid.
Yes. Yes. Excellent point. I really like the moments where you see that Leo is a little piece of all of his brothers, too. You know,
yeah.
He tries to play that straight and narrow, but if Mikey tempts him with a good slice and a dance beat, he might cut loose. And we've seen Leo get angry. We've seen Leo get dangerously angry, like in 2K3.
Yeah, or in 2K7, the TMNT, the movie.
Yeah, I will never forget that scene where he says,
"I'm better than you."
Right?
Whoa, what an amazing Leonardo moment.
Killer, killer scene. I think it comes back to me, like, that it's that point of in every iteration, and I think they played with this a lot in Rise, which makes it so interesting. I know a lot of people were upset when they heard about Rise at first that, like, oh, Leo's not the leader. If he's not the leader, what is it? Well, it was about making him be ready to be the leader.
That was the whole point of that show. I figured that out the second they announced it and said Leonardo is not the leader this time. It's like, oh, it's a hero's quest.
Yeah. It's getting him to the point where he can take on that role. And like you said, he has a little bit of all of his brothers in it. He's smart. He's thoughtful. He's more of like the history person than the scientific person when you compare him to Donnie. But they're both like involved and interested with their minds. He's just more spiritual than Donnie is, and that's where the two kind of part ways. He's into the same kind of like him and Raph can go like super aggressive with each other. It can be very competitive with each other. Him and Mikey can like really bond and speak very like can be very emotional with each other. But he's the one who's been forced to take responsibility for all of them in lieu of their father. And even in like the original Mirage one, like think about what it would be like if you were 16 and not only have your parents or your father figure or whoever, your authority figure said to you, like, you're the man in charge, you're the man of the house now, but also you have to take on my revenge quest.
Yeah, right. And there's people trying to kill him all the time. And dad's like, it's time for you to man up.
Right. That I think that's a thing that like a lot of the animated versions of Splinter have lost that comes back that like that's present in Mirage and comes back in the IDW version, that there's this angle of Splinter that is emotionally closed off. He cares about his family, but there's a job to do. And when there's a job to do, I can't be connected to my family because I need them to work and get the job done. And that's super unhealthy and winds up hurting him and his family basically every time.
But it's a very important part of that dynamic and that chemistry of the family is like, I'm your dad, but I'm also your boss.
Yeah.
Pivoting off what you said earlier, too, about the criticism against Rise, you know, with Raph in that show being designated the leader simply because he's bigger and older. That in itself is a statement, and older is in quotes. But beyond that show always being like case in point to take Leo from a cocky fool into that responsibility role, right?
Yeah.
You know, you should have been able to figure that out for anybody who's still like hemming and hawing over it. They don't cast someone like Ben Schwartz, like a Hollywood It guy at the moment after doing DuckTales Sonic the Hedgehog and then making just him like the quintessential blue person in kids animation. Yeah, you don't put Ben Schwartz in that role when he's surrounded by other more professional voice actors, even though he's very talented at voice acting. He's still a screen actor, yeah. Right? You should have been able to figure that out from the start. I just never really understood why people got mad about that kind of thing. I thought it was a really great experiment and showing that Leo can do more than just make decisions that he doesn't want to make. I also want to cite in IDW, there is an alternate future where Michelangelo has to default as a leader because Leonardo has entered the spiritual plane and Raphael and Don are both missing.
Yeah. Leo just like pieces out like a ghost.
Literally. And then obviously, spoilers for anyone who hasn't read The Last Ronin, that's paramount to this concept as well. I won't say anything more there, yeah. But I will tell you, the Last Ronin is not Leonardo.
It's very interesting how over time they've played with these concepts. And I think like 2012, when they do that future arc, they play on a lot of the same things, except it's kind of it focused more on Raph than the other ones. But it's like, it's this interesting, this is all what 2K7 is. That's what this episode is. That's what Last Ronin is in a lot of ways. It's like, what are the Turtles when their normal roles get inverted in some way, get disturbed, get disrupted? And it's like, you know, like, can Raph lead? What is it like when he does? What happens to Mikey when he doesn't have his family around him? That's been told in like many different ways, right? Like, there, even in Rise in the movie, there's that whole instance of like, you know, I'm it's been a while since I've watched it, but like the future where Casey is coming from, right? What is it like? What is it like when Leo isn't in his element doing the thing that we all know him to do? And in a lot of ways, Rise is like two seasons in a movie of with great power also comes great responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. And let's just say, too, there's another one to kind of observe, not to break your train of thought, but in that Rise movie, Leo passes the torch to Casey. Casey becomes de facto leader.
Yep.
Which I think also cements him as the formal fifth turtle to end that debate.
It's not a lot to say that, like, Leo doesn't have to be the leader. There's a reason that they make such a great team. It's not because they're brothers, you know?
Yeah.
It's because they each bring something to the fold, and all of them are capable of leading. He's just the one that is most suited to do it most of the time.
In the 87 series, he just kind of slouches into the role, right? But our point is that we have seen other iterations and more fleshed out writing that shows why he's a leader, not that he just is a leader.
Yeah, 100%.
And like you said, team above all else. This is about building strength as a team. And Leo, in his peak, leads from behind. He recognizes all of his team, his brothers, his surrogate family strengths, and lets them shine. Makes Donnie the strategist. Lets Mikey get on, you know, down and dirty on the ground. And then just cuts Raph loose, Hulk smash.
And, you know, it does kind of come down to that. But I think, like, to go back to, like, what we first started this tangent on in terms of, like, what is Leo's personality? What would you say Leo's personality is?
I would say that Leo is reluctantly mature. I think that's a key player in this one. That he's the one, he's the big brother syndrome. He's the one who doesn't get to experience none of them really do, but he exceptionally does not get to experience his childhood.
Yeah. Yeah. I would even go so far as to say that at least in some iterations, not 87, but like in some of the iterations of the Turtles, if it wasn't for his responsibility, he would be more lost than Raph is. Like, he would be a worse Raph to like kind of make a colloquialism out of it. I'm not saying Raph is bad, but like if you think about where Raph starts his journey in the 1990 movie, I think without the responsibility, without the weight of his family on his shoulders, Leo would be more lost than that.
Yeah. I would agree to
he's
that.
He's way darker than Raph is if he's allowed to be. And he doesn't let himself to be because he knows how deep that well can go. And Dark Leo in IDW is like the end result of that.
Yeah. It's kind of Batman, right? It's that Batman philosophy where Batman doesn't kill because if you kill a killer, it's the same amount of killers kind of thing. He refuses to cross that line. And I think Leo is motivated by his brothers to not cross that line.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the Batman example, too, it's not just that, like, oh, you cross that line, you become like them. I think there have been some iterations of Batman where, like, if he did, he wouldn't stop.
Mm.
And that's, like, the line, right?
Yeah.
It's, like, where you lose yourself to that darkness, which is a thing that, like, later on in the IDW, when they're training again, I'm not going to spoil things for people who want to read them, but when they're training with a certain somebody in all that spiritual training and they each have like a lesson that they need to learn, Leo's is embracing all of himself, mm-hmm. about not cutting off that side of him, but using it and being able to put it to rest when it's not needed anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. We preach IDW a lot, but for real, if you really want to get into a well-developed Leonardo arc, read IDW.
So good.
he that whole series is amazing, but he exceptionally shines and especially proves our point and disproves the haters who are like, oh, Leonardo's not interesting and doesn't have a personality. IDW changed all of that.
And I mean, like, to bring it back to this episode, it's all here. It's just simplified.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
Leo's personality is the doubt that he feels, the responsibility that he feels, but that like part of him that feels like he can't actually protect his brothers, that he's going to mess up and it's going to cost them. And that's a thing that's come back multiple times too. There's that's a whole thing in the 2012 series where he like sees the visions of his dad. What in the TMNT Batman crossover, that's what I'm thinking of, right?
When
he gets affected by the Scarecrow toxin, his fear is that he's going to fail his brothers and they will die on his watch. That's basically what happened at the beginning of this episode.
That's a good point. I didn't draw that line, but that's a really good point. All right, anyways, end rant. But not before we reference everyone's favorite misnomer. He's the leader of the group. Raph gets elected new leader by playing Spin the Pizza. Let's go back up top and look around, he says. Spoilers, it's a snow day. Everyone go home and watch The Price is Right. No, New York City is buried under snow now, and you can't see anything. There are no buildings. It is just all rolling hills. Mike says, dig all this snow, Raph. I hope we don't have to. The writers assume that if snow materializes, so will snow fauna. So now there's a polar bear, cornering the brothers as we dip to break, and we will be back right after this.
Rang, the master brain from Dimension X, ally of the evil Shredder and Baxter Stockman, the wickedly winged scientists are out to destroy the Ninja Turtles.
Red Duck!
Right, Ace Duck, the turtle's tough feathered friend, along with Dingus Frog, who's always hopping for action, always ready to fight on the side of the turtle.
You'll be riveted to your seat.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
From Playmates.
We got you now, Shredhead! The turtles have Shredder pinned down and are rolling their pizza thrower into position!
I'll blast you with retro mutagen!
But before he can act, the pizza thrower's adjustable aim and motorized firing action give Shredder and his henchmen their just desserts!
You clogged my gun with anchovies!
The turtles and their portable pizza thrower triumph again!
Why are we so happy? We just lost our watch!
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles!
From Playmates!
And we're back. So, a polar bear. My notes just say thumbs up. Also penguins. Also igloos. Also frozen fountains. But I don't see any remnant of the rest of the cityscape or streets or cars. It's just snowy mountains covering everything.
Because they're in the zoo.
Way to give it away.
That's my job.
I like that Raph is consistently trying to quit and duck out of his responsibility, which just seems really in character for him.
Yeah.
And Donatello's the one who keeps pushing him back. Like, oh, no, you can't quit yet.
Like, none of them want this.
No, of course not. It's no fun.
And also,
they see how miserable Leonardo is.
Right before they leave for the snow day, like, Splinter is still just like, yeah, whatever.
Yep.
Nothing to say.
This polar bear, which is animated terrifyingly, by the way, he approaches and Michelangelo does what he does best, make peace by feeding it fish that he's chipped out of the frozen fountain. So I'm guessing they're in Lincoln Center. Yeah, there's not supposed to be live trout in there.
No, definitely not.
So yeah, like you said, we're in the zoo. Still probably shouldn't be live fish in a public fountain, but that's for another day. Mikey is uncharacteristically focused in this episode. Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
He puts the bickering Raph and Don back on task by like, hey, you know, the sun's fucking shrinking. And then Donatello, of course, whips out a MacGuffin energy tracker that he just invented, of course. And then Raph passes the torch. You've got the strategy. You've got the answers. You're the leader now.
Where did it come from?
He just invented it. Didn't you hear him? Raphael doesn't like Don's leadership technique, though, because he's too thorough and slow while he makes calculations instead of diving into the action unprepared. Really, really good character development there, again. Just showing that Raph is eager and overzealous, and Donatello is slow-paced and methodical. And
yeah.
I love all this happening here. You know, most of the time in the show, you kind of throw it to the wayside. They're going to make jokes. We're going to have fun. But there is legitimate development here.
Well, a lot of this stuff is like Leo. The first time that they've tried to do this in three seasons. Like, for the longest...
That's the problem.
Yeah. For the longest time, like, you knew, oh, Donnie's a smart one because he keeps making weird shit out of nowhere. But...
And because the theme song tells you.
Right. But now they're actually, like, developing on that idea that, like, yeah, he is extremely thorough. And it turns out that if you left him to his own devices, he wouldn't get anything done.
Yeah.
Like, it takes him 20 minutes to figure out where East is when Raph is standing next to him being like, it's that way.
looking up would help, Donatello.
And that's his whole thing, right? Like, that is such interesting character development for a cartoon like this.
Yeah, it's really above and beyond. That really stood out to me watching this one. Meanwhile, over at Channel 6, the entire building is snowed in. And everybody is bundled up on the staff. They're literally trapped inside because the snow has closed the doors. Can't do much. Can't even call on the Turtlecom because it's frozen solid. I don't know why we wasted our time over here.
Right? They're just like, hey, over at Channel 6, it sucks. Moving on.
Leo's off self-destructing and self-lamenting while the world literally freezes over and civil war has broken out between Donatello, Michelangelo, and Raphael, the latter two having a vicious snowball fight while Don's still calculating which way East is.
Yeah, so much for Mikey staying on task.
I mean, you expect him to get off task. At least now it's on brand. Back over at the Mile High Tower, Trevor and company are all bundled up. Trevor's got a fly as fuck brown overcoat with black fur trim. He's got his trademark purple ascot. Bebop's got a red scarf, a down jacket with a beanie. Rocksteady's rocking a bomber jacket with earmuffs. I like that he stayed in character and on brand for that one, too. And I don't know if it really makes any sense, but Krang's all decked out with a scarf and a hat.
Yeah, the body is.
The robot
Krang
body
is not.
You would assume that Krang's probably got climate control in that thing, right?
I hope so. I mean, this is the thing that, like, on the toy, there's a whole, like, glass front that has to be opened so that he can get out of it. In the animated, in the cartoon, it feels like there is nothing.
Yeah, no encasement. He's just, like, open to the elements, and he's a squishy wet brain, so he's probably going to get like telephone pulled soon. Back to the story. The sun is almost drained at this point, and Trevor says they'll be in charge once everyone's cryo frozen and they need to be thawed out. This is the origins of Snowpiercer, by the way, I think. They also say that they'll make the humans slaves, and Bebop and Rocksteady are excited about having their own goons to push around instead of being Trevor's slaves. To which Trevor responds by having a classic tantrum and belting them with various objects and dolls that are just hanging out in this building for some reason.
Really wish I knew what this building was.
Rocksteady says,
oh, where's that Abe Lincoln guy when you need him?
Do you ever, like, watch an episode and there's a part where you're like, kind of not paying attention or like half paying attention, and then one of the characters says, where's that Abe Lincoln guy when you need him? And you cut right back to, oh, I caught that.
Yeah. I'm awake now. Donatello has tracked the energy signal to a schoolhouse, and let's point out that the cold-blooded amphibians are still running around nude.
Yep.
Snow falls and traps them inside the schoolhouse. Donatello's logic is that if they stop the energy drainer or device, the snow will thaw, but, like, if the sun is reduced in size overall, you're going to put all that back? Also, the schoolhouse in the middle of Manhattan looks like it was constructed in the 1800s. The TMNT head upstairs. Donatello slips on the ice and takes a brutal fall down the stairs chin first. It was legitimately painful to watch. That was at about 13 minutes and 55 for anybody looking for the actual scene. And I guess this is an animation error. So when Donatello falls down and he just kind of like beats, like eats shit on the stairs, when he gets to the bottom, he wipes out Mike and Raph and they all just kind of like dogpile. and careen across the floor, across the ice, and they're all screaming and yelling. And if you listen really close,
I was gonna say it too, yeah,
you can hear Cam Clark's voice in there. So they must have just used like a stock, like, okay, all four brothers yell in fear.
Yep.
Okay, we'll just keep that for later.
Yep, you can hear Leo screaming, and it happens again later in the episode.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now the TMNT have geared up with foot cleats, or snow boots for everybody else.
It's the footwear they use to climb buildings.
Yeah, but these are clearly just like snow boots from like Dick's Sporting Goods.
I know, but it's funny that they're like, we need our ninja climbing gear.
The boots.
From Modell's.
I like the line where they said that they had to look all over town for turtle wits. Efficient use of time. They reach the top and find a gadget that was designed to distract the turtles from finding the actual energy device that Donatello was looking for, aka the laser. There's an actual smart foresight from Shredder right here.
Yeah, he's finally thinking.
He outsmarted the smart one. I just, like, they've gotten to the point, the show is so meta that they MacGuffin the MacGuffins with a MacGuffin.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have a slight thing here. I'm, like, what does Mikey throw at the bell?
An icicle.
Because it's just a funny animation thing. I'm going to point out two things. When you watch him, he puts his hand behind his back. It doesn't look like he's taking it from the ground. It looks like he's taking it from, like, his belt.
And oh, yeah, yeah.
It kind of looks like the alien crystal.
Oh, like he just has the Eye of Sarnath in his back pocket. He's like, well, this will work.
Yep. He just throws it.
Yeah, it kind of does look like that. I just figured it was an icicle. But yeah, you're right. He does kind of pull it from his pocket. So
like he's just been holding on to it this whole time. No one's been using it.
That seems like a Mikey thing to do. He's like, oh, cool icicle. I'll keep this for later. I would have done that when I was like 5 years old. Are you kidding me? we forgot to mention, too, that the distraction device that Shredder planted is also a bomb and it's going to go off in 10 seconds.
Yep.
So naturally, we're going to bicker a little bit more, and 15 seconds pass by before Mikey uses the aforementioned icicle to cut down the school bell, hanging from the ceiling, punching a hole in the floor, dropping them so that they can drop the bomb down into the hole. It always kind of drove me nuts in media when there's literally an active countdown, but it's wrong.
Yeah.
Like anytime there's a bomb on screen and they're like, it's only 15 seconds until it explodes. And then the entire 22 minute episode transpires. You ever do that? It's like, do you try to time it out yourself? Or like when somebody goes underwater in a movie, do you hold your breath with them? I do that shit.
I have done that a couple times, except in Mission Impossible films, because Tom Cruise actually does that shit for real.
Yeah, I don't want to go anywhere near that kind of crazy.
Or like, I think in the newest Avatar, Kate Winslet broke a record or something.
Oh, for underwater? Yeah.
Yeah. She held her breath for like 3 minutes or something.
Fuck that.
I think it's really funny how when I thought that they were going to cut the bell down to cover the bomb.
And yeah, me too.
And instead they just destroyed the fucking school.
Yeah, it blows the whole facade off the building. It doesn't just blow the door open, it blows the entire front of the building off.
They drop the bell through the floor, so no second floor anymore, and then the bomb blows up the rest of the building.
Well, I guess they're free now.
They did get out. One problem solved.
Meanwhile, though, the other problem that needs to be solved is the fact that the sun has shrunk so much that it's nighttime at 3 p.m, and if that's the case, it is too late.
Yeah.
Everybody's dead.
World's over.
Go home. Donatello runs back to the lair to replace his busted energy tracker, and that makes Michelangelo de facto leader in God Help Us All. The snow has become too heavy, it's knocking down the Brooklyn Bridge. The old man guard there is pretty cavalier about the green-faced punker in a puffy coat out for a walk during the snowpocalypse, and they just spark up a conversation.
Yep.
Leo, though, finally does pull his head out of his ass and springs back into action because he knows his brothers will need him.
Yeah, he's like, oh, wait a second. People are in danger. This isn't just about me.
Before we move forward with the plot, we need to swing back over to Channel 6 for another pointless visit to find out that April has started a fire to thaw out the Turtlecom, and then Irma throws the entire thing into the fire.
Why is this in the episode?
Because they need to justify the paychecks for Irma, April, and Burn. Vernon doesn't even show up. You notice that? Come on.
Yep.
Mikey proves to be the most adept leader so far by identifying the energy beam by looking up.
Looking up. Hey, Raph tried getting Donnie to do it before.
As Mike and Raph approach the building, the sentry bot spots them and attacks. Now, I just get vibes of Tears of the Kingdom drone constructs, by the way, this little short circuit reject works.
Yeah, I can see that.
I don't know about you. The robot has got Mike and Raph in dire straits, but Leo shows up just in time to stab it in the back and then take a full 180 on his self-loathing. He went from, like, no one's going to care about me. Leo's full-on bipolar in this.
I mean, he just, he needed one good adventure. He got to save his brothers, and he's like, hey, look, I was right. They'd be dead without me.
I mean, I'm not shaming. Everybody needs some downtime and a little personal time, but, like, he goes from, like, they don't need me to, I knew you guys would get into trouble without me.
Yeah.
That's TV logic for you.
22-minute turnaround.
Donatello's back, too. Good thing he had the MacGuffin. They start climbing the elevator cables to the roof to confront Trevor.
I do want to, like, just, before we get back to Trevor, I think we should highlight that, like...
I like that you've latched onto that, too.
Well, I like a good running joke. Mikey, like you mentioned, he's the first one that actually, like, is kind of a good leader besides Leo. And I
because he just uses logic.
Right. I think it's... Well, it's not even logic. It's intuition.
Oh, better put, yeah.
Like, he has that same kind of, like, emotional connection that Leo does. Like, he knows to think outside of himself. That's his whole thing. He's, you know, like, I think you even brought up when we first started talking about this. Like, there's a little bit of, like, savant in Mikey.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually something that comes up. I haven't read it yet. You have read it. But that's, I saw that that's, like, a line out of one of the more recent comics that, like, if Mikey put in just, like, a little bit more effort, he'd probably be the best of them.
Well, I think that's one of the best underlying subplots in the 2K3 series is how Michelangelo is technically the best fighter, hence why he wins the Battle Nexus.
Mm.
I think we overlook that a lot. Like, Michelangelo is not the fuck up. He's just the goof off.
Yeah.
He's actually very skilled and talented.
He's just a little immature.
A little.
Well, you know, it changes from iteration to iteration.
Fair. I missed this detail before, too, but, well, the camera pulls back for the inevitable big brawl up at the top of the tower. Krang has mittens and booties as well.
I didn't see the booties. I saw the mittens before.
They match. They match. It's adorable.
I mean, like, he's got the whole ensemble. There's the hat, the earmuffs, the scarf, the gloves.
Why did we not get that toy?
We gotta go on Etsy. Somebody can make that for us.
Probably. Frozen Tundra Krang. Also, let's take a second and appreciate Trevor's dedication to wearing his metallic armor during this blizzard, because he must be absolutely telephone poling from the neck down.
Yeah, exactly. And that shit stuck to him.
That is a Christmas Story reference for those who haven't caught it yet.
He could take that off if he wanted to.
Yeah, he's screwed. At the top of Mile High Tower, the TMNT quickly dispatch Bebop and Rocksteady with a little help from the ice, and Krang's apparently useless and is overpowered by Raph easily. The bad guys panic when Donatello reverses the laser, and they jump off the roof and parachute down. Four purple parachutes, because bad guys, they gotta be purple.
One with a smiley face.
One with a smiley face. Who do you think it was?
It's gotta be Shredder.
You think so? No, I think it's Krang.
But doesn't he say, like, have a nice day when he's parachuting down?
Oh my god, he does, you're right! I didn't piece that together. Holy shit, Shredder is master troll in this.
It's his little convenience to go bag.
That's amazing. Like, think about this for a second. This guy is an interdimensional Japanese-born martial arts warlord. Right. And he's out to conquer the world, but he's got enough time to raise a middle finger to his enemies, even when he's losing.
Honestly, like, I would kill for just one, like, quote unquote, behind the scenes shot of him painting that parachute. I know these guys are going to beat me, but fuck them. I'll get the last laugh.
You're absolutely right, though. I was like, it could be anyone. I want to think it's Krang because no, you're right. It was Shredder the whole time. Holy shit. TMNT minus Don chased the villains to the ground, but too late. They've drilled away. Trevor's been draining the sun all day, but Don reverses it in about 30 seconds, and then presumably everything melts, and it's all back to normal.
Yep. Everything's good. Earth saved.
Back at the lair, the turtles debrief with their non-confrontational father. They recap what they learned. Leo has overcome doubt. Donatello trusts his instincts over his machines. Raph learns it's easier to make wisecracks than decisions. And this has got to be the first time he's canonically given Leo a break, right? And then Mike learns you should stick to what you do best. Scarfing down pizza.
See, I love this scene because we don't have to talk about what the lesson of the episode is.
It's spelled out for us.
Here it is.
But I kind of want to expand on it. So this one, while maybe not the most inventive or exciting episode, has definitely, as we mentioned, has some of the best character development, character writing the series has seen so far. Legitimate development and acknowledgement. The focus is fully on the turtles and not really split with the villains or the support as much. We have obligatory swings over to Channel 6 and the Technodrome, but it never really carries any weight.
Yeah.
Our focus is on learning what the brothers are feeling and thinking. And that is something you don't see in a kid's show, not this show especially, at this early on in its career. I thought it was really great, and simply for the aspect of all of this development, Dan, I'm going to give this one a cowabunga.
I really liked it. I agree with you. I think there's some like really fun character stuff. Obviously, we talked a lot about it, but I even like this summary at the end because it puts it so succinctly some of the more like nuanced things that the cartoon's trying to show. Like the idea that like in this iteration, Raph is the wise guy, right? Like he...
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, that's Raph is the confident one. He has all of this confidence. But we learn from this episode that his confidence is dependent on his brothers being there with him and allowing him to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
That like if he's the one in charge, he can't he loses his confidence and he can't do the wisecracks. He can't make the jokes. He can't keep the bad guys on their like off balance. Because he's too worried about everything around him. And I love that idea that Raph is so dependent on his brothers in a different way than what we're used to seeing.
Oh, that's my, that when they show how vulnerable Raph really is, those are the moments that really speak to me. Raph has been my favorite turtle for the longest time because I myself am a rage case, believe it or not. But there's so many moments when you realize like he's motivated by that passion. And I feel that in me so many ways. Where, like, even again in like, that 2K7, that confrontation, the way it comes to the head, or just, fuck, back to the 1990 movie. Leo, don't. Like, those little moments say so much about his character. And, yeah, I love that you're bringing that up and showcasing that leadership responsibility is detracting from the characterization, from their personality traits. Leo has to constantly step up and take on that burden.
Yeah.
And he doesn't get a chance to be himself as much. And that's why even in things like 2012, when he emotionally connects with someone like Karai, let's not get into kind of the icky parts of that. That's a little weird. but the emotional dependency he develops with Karai and the codependency that they have is a really interesting thing that speaks about his and her characters.
Yeah. Well, in 2012, both of them suffer the weight of expectation.
Yes. Yes. Great. Great way to say that.
We got a little bit of that in this episode, but like Karai is such a great counterbalance for Leo in that show.
Yeah, I got to say, like, I was having a conversation with some stranger on the internet the other day, and just like in retrospect, what they did with Karai in that 2012 series makes her hands down one of the most interesting characters across the franchises.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love that show.
Yeah, it's really great. I mean, we love almost everything Turtles.
It's true.
All right. So they basically spelled out the lesson for us to learn previously in the epilogue, but I kind of wanted to give it a more general overarching lesson, and that is the value of teamwork. You know, that is, you could say that's the basis for the entire franchise.
Yeah.
But this is such a great exemplification of it. Exemplification. It's such a great example of it. this episode just, it really shines. You know, we've had a good bout of some goofy, silly, forgettable one-off Monster of the Week kind of stuff. This, I think this goes in the top 10 most important episodes of the series.
It's really great. I mean, it actually takes time out to show how much they rely on each other and why that's important. And the funny thing about it is that, like, normally when we get these kinds of episodes or storylines, Splinter is so central to it. And while we made fun of the idea that Splinter's just kind of, like, not doing anything. Like, he's, like, the idea that he used the end of the world as a way to teach his sons a lesson is a little shitty. But from an audience perspective, I think it's really interesting to see the Turtles learn these lessons by themselves. That's not just something that's, like, fed to them or that is, like, a quote unquote lesson. Like, I think we get a lot of these iterations where, like, it's Splinter working with the Turtles, and then one of them goes on has a one-on-one conversation with Splinter, and then, like, they learn something from it and they try something out in the field. Like, no, this was, like, all them the whole time. And there's something really interesting and unique about that.
I mean, it would completely detract from the point of the episode if Splinter was intervening in any way, shape, and form. You know, we, like you said, we made the jokes, but it was important for him to take a back seat in this one, because if he didn't, what's the point of Leonardo?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, like, think of how many times you've had that shot of, like, Leo going to Splinter and being like, I can't teach them. I can't lead them. They won't do what I want them to. They won't listen to what I have to say. And Splinter turns around like, oh, well, you have to listen to them. And like all that kind of thing. You know, like that. I think that's what we're more used to seeing. And it's so interesting to see, like, the 87 cartoon be the one to be like, well, let them learn by themselves, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's the deep end, right? You gotta walk before you run kind of situation.
Yeah.
I was legitimately pleasantly surprised at how profound this episode came across.
It's a good one. I honestly, I think this might be my favorite of the season so far.
Oh, I think I'm with you on that one for sure. Before we let you go, we're going to give you your weekly pizza affirmation, and we're going to leave you with a quote from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 32nd President of the United States of America. I'm not the smartest fellow or chef in the world, but I sure can pick smart colleagues and toppings. Coming up next week!
If she's a queen, then who are we?
You are my friends! Athos, Porthos, and Aramis, of course! The Three Musketeers!
Oh, swell. Then who, pray tell, might you be?
Why, I'm D'Artagnan, naturally.
Uh-oh, looks like our head dude just came unglued.
Thanks for listening. Like, comment, subscribe, jump in the Discord, get in the comments, and make sure to tell every living being you know about Deuteronomy, a Ninja Turtles retread. Cowabunga, and we'll see you next time.
Cowabunga!
Deuteronomy is produced by Brian Van Gelder and me, Dan Spitaleri. Brian edits and mixes the show and also designed our show art. Our theme music is composed by Mario Cello Nunez. You can hear more of his music on Spotify, which we've linked to in the show notes. Find us on Twitter at Deuteronomy_TMNT and send email to Deuteronomy.TMNT@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Cowabunga!
Stupid question time. When does the bomb go off?
Exactly 10 seconds from now!